Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about everything and anything having to do with writing. Today my guests are Barbara Serinella, author of Unwanted Company, and Martha Lawrence, author of Aquarius Descending. Barbara's worked as an auto mechanic, and Martha has been a book editor, professional astrologer, and business writer. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
You there, Martha?
Thank you. Yes, hi, Barbara.
Hi,
Martha.
Again. I should say, too, that Barbara and Martha know each other well, so this will be fun. Martha is at home near San Diego, and Barbara and I are in the studio.
I wish I could be there to join you guys.
Me too. You wouldn't have found parking, but it was nice to have you.
Parking's a problem. Another interesting thing is their current book is the third one for each of them. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Martha's almost a book ahead of me, really.
Almost.
The new book's coming out next month.
Hey, you're keeping up with me, Martha. I'm impressed.
Yeah.
And both came to writing from very interesting backgrounds, and I'd love it if both of you would talk about how you came to writing. Barbara, do you want to start?
All right. Being a writer was always my dream. When I was a little kid, that was my first choice of what I wanted to be when I grew up. And then I learned in junior high school that writers really don't support themselves, that they have another job, and they write for the love of writing, but to support themselves, they need a bread-and-butter job. So I sort of put it on hold, and then I was lucky enough when I was 36 to meet my husband, who made it possible for me to quit being an auto mechanic and start writing my great American novel, which, of course, I had to throw in the trash can, but learn how to write and take classes and stuff, and here I am.
Well, save that, because Joanne Mapson gave a talk last week and said that her first novel, which she couldn't sell, was horrible, and now her fifth novel, or she's going on her sixth, Boston University has made arrangements with her to collect her letters. So they have her first novel, which was never published, and she said it's just the most awful thing.
Oh, I'd be so embarrassed. It is awful.
So, keep it. Martha, how about you?
Well, I found out the same thing that Barbara did. I was graduated from college and figured out very quickly that being a writer didn't really pay the bills. But I always knew I wanted to be a writer, and I sort of went in the back door. I started working for Simon & Schuster in New York as an editorial assistant and gradually worked my way up to being an editor at Harcourt Brace Publishers. So I always felt like an imposter at the publishing companies because I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I learned a great deal about the publishing business. And I just want to say, I want to comment on Barbara's comment that she supported herself as an auto mechanic, because I remember, Barbara, once we were on a panel and I had made the comment, which is true, that you are a stunning writer. I just love your work. And made some sort of clumsy comment about, you know, it's so startling that this kind of work could come out of an auto mechanic.
Yeah, you said I don't write like an auto mechanic.
And Barbara snaps right back at me, well, what does an auto mechanic write like?
So. Yeah, people have this image of auto mechanics as these Neanderthals with knuckles dragging on the ground. And, you know, it's really a very sophisticated job. It's a blue-collar job, but, you know, you have to have some smarts to do it.
Oh, definitely.
It's like being a doctor, I always used to say.
Well, that's what I was about to say.
Yeah.
And plus, you know, the knowledge you bring to
except
your...
we took no oath. We turned down Peugeots. No.
You should take an oath for working on cars. I think that's a good idea.
No, no Volkswagen bugs, no Peugeots, no.
But the knowledge you put into your book regarding cars is really interesting, too.
Yeah, and also the perspective of being a female auto mechanic. And I started in the 70s when, you know, there really weren't any women doing auto mechanics back then. So I have a lot of interesting viewpoints from that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Really, it never really worked against me as much as it worked for me.
I think, Barbara, you write about being an auto mechanic. You make it sound like it's an art form. I mean, truly, it's beautiful the way you write about it.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which is that I'm curious, and I know both of you, so some of what I'm asking you might seem silly since I probably know these things, but our listeners don't. So would you say that both of you have written books largely based on your experience? There's a lot of your auto mechanic stuff in your books. There's a lot of, Martha, your the psychic slant on life, the New Age slant on life, in your book. So I'm curious if you would say your books
and
are based on your
Martha
experience.
Martha is a self-trained private investigator now. I mean, she told me once that if she wasn't writing, she'd be a private investigator, that she loves it. And I've heard her tell me stories of stuff she's done to track down different information. It's really impressive. So
I want to hear one of these.
Well, you go first.
Then we'd have to kill you. Should I go first?
Yeah, go first.
Okay. Yeah, I use a lot of personal experiences. I also was involved in a lot of subculture activities that I draw from, because I feel like I have I've been insane and hung around with bikers and done all that crazy stuff, and from a perspective of being restored to sanity now, I can give you an insight into that world from knowing what I was thinking when I was doing it and looking at it now, what a rational person, how they would view that sort of thing. So that's a unique viewpoint that I can bring to the writing, as well as the auto mechanic stuff. But you use everything. I mean, I was making a cake with my niece, and she starts spreading this applesauce, and she says, "Always the bridesmaid, never the bride." I just, you know, so of course the kid in my book has to say this, because it was such a funny thing, you know. Just whatever comes up, you use.
What about you, Martha?
Well, I just think, Barbara, it's amazing that you could retain the memory of walking on the other side, and you bring it into your novels so with such clarity. I think a lot of people who have been wild and crazy, maybe they blew out so many brain cells they couldn't write about it.
I used to work with a guy who says, "I wonder how smart you were before." I'm like, what?
Well, yes, I write about a psychic detective, and that comes from my experience of having been psychic from the time I was small and having a number of psychic experiences, including growing up in a house that had a ghost in it and having dreams that later came true. I dreamed my mom was in a car accident and at a certain spot in the road, and in fact she was in an accident in that very spot several years later. Things like that have happened to me all my life. And what inspired me to write the Elizabeth Chase mystery series is that people who wrote about psychics wrote about them in such a way that I wanted to throw the books across the room because they were so silly and over the top. So that's really what inspired my series.
What about the mystery genre? How did each of you choose to write mysteries? Did it seem that your subject matter naturally went that way, or what was it? Did you love reading mysteries growing up as an adult?
You know, I did not sit down to write. I knew I wanted to write a book, and I wanted to write a novel that people would read and enjoy. And so I really didn't set out to write a mystery. But it's really a great framework for writing a story, because you have your whole plot line. I mean, you know there's going to be a murder, you know there's going to be a sleuth, detectives, there's going to be suspects, and there's going to be a resolution at the end. And then whatever freshness you can bring to it with your characters and your writing and place and whatever else. So I knew of this girl who had committed a murder, which I started to write about, and then that grew into my first novel. So that's how it became a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Martha?
Well, I came to mysteries through my publishing experience. When I was an editor at Harcourt, I worked on a project called the New Black Mask Quarterly. The Black Mask, as you might know, was a famous magazine back in the 30s that published, the early greats. And so working on this new anthology, I discovered Elroy and Peretzky and Grafton and, you know, all the greats, Robert Parker. And whenever I was working on that mystery anthology, it didn't feel like I was working. It felt like I was goofing off and utterly having fun. And so I fell in love with the mystery form then and knew that that's what I wanted to write.
Did you know you wanted to write a series?
I wasn't sure that anyone would even publish the first book, because I knew that writing about a psychic detective was considered cheating, because, of course, the psychic could use non-rational means to discern who the killer was, and that was considered cheating. That's based on the stereotype that a psychic can control psychic impressions, which, of course, we can't. So I wasn't really even sure I'd get the first book published, so I tentatively sent out three chapters saying, you know, anyone have any interest, and, you know, very quickly got picked up and encouraged to do a series. So that's sort of how that happened.
We've talked about this before, but no doubt there are listeners who didn't hear you last time you were on it. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about just the mystery genre and how if you maybe had paid attention to people who said, oh, no one's going to buy a New Age mystery. It's just not done. You know, it seems that in the mystery genre there are certain rules, and one of them is you don't write New Agey stuff.
Right. Well, you know, I think this is true for if there's anyone out there listening who is working on a project and they're hearing a lot of negative feedback about an idea they have, I think you have to write from your heart, and Barbara knows this
right.
too. If it's true for you, if it is really your truth, that's what's going to ring true on the page. And don't pay so much attention to what the publishing industry is saying or, you know, what people at the writers' conference are saying.
Absolutely. They always say, oh, well, World War II is dead, and then you have great blockbuster World War II things.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, who would have thought on Cold Mountain, you know, the Civil
right.
War
mm-hmm.
saga, you know, look.
Right.
I mean, if they'd pitched that idea, they would have said, nah, I don't think people are interested.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest, Barbara Serinella, author of Unwanted Company, and Martha Lawrence, author of Aquarius Descending. The time is 4:16. I wonder if each of you would read, and because I haven't told you I was going to ask you this, Martha, maybe Barbara could...
Yeah, maybe Barbara can start.
just a few minutes.
We'll read
minutes.
Each other's stuff. How's that?
Give our listeners a taste of what you do, and...
What I have here is a prologue, and then I'll read a couple pages into chapter one, and you'll just have to give me the high sign when I've reached 5 minutes, and I'll try to edit out any bad words, because I write kind of hard-boiled stuff that has some bad words in it. Okay, the name of the book is Unwanted Company. Prologue. Christmas, 1983. Artificial green garlands wound around the lamppost, topped with aluminum silver stars. Movie-going crowds thronged the wet sidewalks. Colored lights twinkled, and Christmas carols played from speakers mounted over the doorways of the shops. The stores were filled with merchandise and still open, even though it was almost 9 in the evening. Only in America, he thought. He'd been in Los Angeles for less than a week and was hungry for diversion. It had been raining most of the week and drizzling off and on all evening. He understood that this was unusual for Los Angeles, even in December. The newscasters blamed it on an El Nino weather front. He chose an apartment building in Westwood, one of the high-rises on Wilshire. The building had underground parking, keyed electronic gates, and a doorman manning the lobby, just the sort of place where people relaxed their vigilance. Westwood was also a college town, full of brazen young women who only had eyes, it seemed, for the sculpted torsos and bronze skin of their contemporaries. He found their overt sexuality offensive. Such decadence usually signaled a civilization's downfall. Didn't they teach history in universities anymore? He pushed the button to signal the elevator. He liked to begin at the top of a building and work down, checking for open doors as he went. He was not able to reach the penthouse, lacking the required key for the elevator. His one foible, these crimes, though he hesitated to use such a harsh word, were acts of opportunity. Harmless peeks into the worlds of others. The urges had begun when he was quite young, a boy of 10. Confusing as they were irresistible. But what does a boy that age understand of anything? To satisfy his impulses, he took things from people's homes. Worthless things, socks, belts, birth certificates, the majority of which he later discarded. The panties, particularly the pink and the blue ones, he kept. And later, alone in his room, the feel of the nylon or cotton or silk against his skin brought a gratifying emission that was both terrifying and splendid. It was as if his body were filled with some volatile, churning substance which, while making him more alive than most, also needed periodic venting. By the time he turned 16, just the sight of an open window gave him an erection. Though he was disconcerted when sometimes it took many trips to the window before he could achieve the desired release. As his taste grew more refined, he discovered and devoured books on sex and crime, reading with great interest the works of Freud and material on subjects of masochism, fetishism, sadism, and flagellation. Not that he needed the famous psychiatrist to tell him that the burglaries were about sex, or that discretion regarding his taste in entertainment was crucial. Nearly a decade ago, when he had left home for university, he had almost been caught. Quick thinking and a few words in the right ear saved him. But from then on, he resolved to be a better person and exercise control. He recognized then the need to change his habits. At the time, he believed his activities were probably just a passing phase. He'd even started dating girls, even though he found women quite repulsive. His only requirement was that the woman be quiet and lie very still. And then he was able to get himself into a state where he could perform. And wasn't rising above one's inhibitions the mark of a great man, a man of consequences? In his second year of studies, he put aside psychology and shifted his focus to history. What better way to achieve greatness than to learn from those singular men who dared to go beyond the boundaries? He had no intention of living his life as a sheep, a mere follower. The elevator came to a stop. His attention was riveted on the opening doors. He took a deep breath and stepped out. A woman emerged from her apartment just as the doors of his elevator closed behind him. She was dressed in a three-piece knit suit with simple but expensive jewelry. The look on her face suggested that she neither gave nor asked for any quarter. Not the sort of woman too many men would be attracted to, he supposed. Too strong, too willful. In a way, she reminded him of his mother. He walked over to the stairwell door. In the reflection of the fire extinguisher's glass case, he saw she had spotted him. At least, he thought she had. He was having difficulty concentrating. His head hurt, and he'd begun to sweat. He stepped back until the darkness of the hallway shadows enveloped him. He would have willed himself invisible, but then a powerful anger overcame him. Who is this? Can I say that one?
No.
Oh. Who was this bad lady to throw him into such a panic? Did she think she was better than he? He left the dark corner she thought to have boxed him in. What? He asked her. She acted like she didn't know what he was talking about. He grabbed her arm and shoved her inside. Before she could make a sound, he wrapped his arm around her throat. The pounding of his blood, his juices, drowned out all other sounds, all other considerations. Within a few moments, she was still. He released her. As her body crumpled to the floor, his headache also began to abate.
Thank you. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you've just tuned in, you've heard Barbara Serinella read from the beginning of Unwanted Company. I'm curious, Barbara, where this particular story came from. Your stories are all so different.
Oh. Well, you know, what I do is I have one situation leads to another. There's a character in this book, Ellen, who's a sidekick, an old running friend of Munch's. Munch Mancini being my protagonist, the auto mechanic with the past. And I thought about this true person named Ellen who was so outrageous, and I thought, I have got to write a book with Ellen in it. So, and then I thought it'd be interesting to set it around the Olympics in Los Angeles because that was such an interesting time in 1984. And so I just sort of knew different elements that I wanted involved, and then I just said, okay, well, Munch will have this limo business, which I had a limo business, so I could write from experience there. And then it was just like, what happens next? What happens, given who these people are, what's going to happen next? Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of discovered as I go along.
Mm-hmm. Themes that run through your work. Martha.
Yes.
Do you have, can you talk about the themes that run through your work? Do you feel that you're on a track with themes? Or do you really try to, I mean, you have certain things that have to stay the same because you have a series character, as do you, Barbara, but I'm just curious how you work with themes and how you pay attention.
Can I answer that question after I direct a question to Barbara?
Sure.
I just wanted to know where the character Munch got her name. I think that's an interesting name.
I actually knew a girl that we used to call Munch because she was little and it was short for Munchkin. And I just liked how that sounded, and it worked for me. And I pictured this, the murderer that I met that I based Munch on was a little girl, was a small woman. So I just thought she was a Munchkin. Yeah.
And Mancini, it's such an interesting last name to go with Munch.
Yeah, that's just one of those names that pop into your mind, and you know it works. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wondered if it had anything to do with the painter who did the screen.
No, it had much more to do with Wizard of Oz. I have a character named Ruby, I have a character named Oz, and I have a character named Munch, so I was thinking of that quite often.
Okay, well, back to Barbara's, thank you, Barbara,
thank you.
To the other Barbara's deep question about themes. I have a built-in theme schedule in my novels because they're all based on signs of the zodiac, and if you understand anything about esoteric astrology, which is quite different from day-to-day sun sign astrology that you read in the newspaper, which is just utter BS, you know, it's meaningless. But there are deeper themes with each sign of the zodiac, and so each book basically picks up the the theme from the sign. So, for example, Murder in Scorpio, obviously, is about death and rebirth. And Pisces Rising, the book that's coming out in March, is about suffering and spiritual enlightenment. So each book has a theme like that.
Mm. What about you, Barbara, in terms of themes?
Hmm. You know, I really liked Martha's second book, Capricorn Rising. It had a real, you know, by theme, do you mean like a social theme?
Just anything that sort of is the overall kind of overview of what you're going for.
I think you can't help to finish the thought with mm-hmm. Martha's book. It was a book about rape and misconceptions about rape. I thought it was a very important book in that, because she did a really nice job of putting in a lot of facts and, mm-hmm. and misnomers and stuff. Misconceptions. I think that, you know, you don't want to preach, but I can't help but having my attitudes come into the book and my character. So my themes, my social themes of, you know, certainly an anti-drug message, bikers are weenies kind of message, you know, don't break the law, you go to jail message. I even now I'm sort of getting more of an appreciation for police all the time. The more I talk to police, I'm feeling much better about them and really appreciating them, which is sort of chagrins my husband. But, you know, you kind of learn as you go along. So that all always comes into the writing, whatever you're learning socially as you go along. And I am writing a rape book now, so I'm getting pretty involved in that whole thing.
It's interesting what you said about the police, because I flashed on you in the Haight-Ashbury in, what, the late 70s?
Uh-huh.
Would you ever imagine yourself saying this, you know, 20 years later?
I'm the one who nailed the sign in Golden Gate Park, because it was like a no dogs in the park sign, so I made my own sign, no pigs in the park, and I nailed it to a tree. That was me at 15.
Oh, God. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be here still with Barbara Serinella, author of Unwanted Company, and Martha Lawrence, author of Aquarius Descending. And I would hope that Martha would grace us with her reading when we get back as well. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm here with Barbara Serinella, author of Unwanted Company. And on the line is Martha Lawrence, author of Aquarius Descending. Martha.
Barbara.
Will you read to us?
I would be happy to. I'd like to do something a little radical, if I may. I know we're talking about Aquarius Descending today, which is available in paperback now at stores everywhere. But what I have in my lap is a galley of Pisces Rising.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Out next month. And I just thought I might read a little bit from that.
Sure.
This will be the first, this is the Virgin reading.
All right.
Book, so.
Here on KUCI, year is 2000.
Okay, this is from the prologue. I guess I'll do what Barbara did. The prologue's pretty short, so I'll do that and just a bit of chapter one. It's been nearly 10 years since I earned my PhD in parapsychology from Stanford University. The certificate collects dust on the wall of my office. Framed parchment from the archives of a more innocent era. I suppose the degree has a place in my life, but these days it doesn't serve me as well or as often as my 9mm Glock, from which I can hit a bullseye at 15 feet, 4 times out of 5. My name is Elizabeth Chase. I'm a licensed private investigator with a specialty. I am a psychic. I know, I hate the word too. So many charlatans and rip-off artists have hung out their shingles under the term psychic that it's hard to take the title seriously. I use it for lack of a better alternative. To call myself a sensitive makes me sound like a character in Star Trek, The Next Generation. Parapsychologist, detective? Too many syllables, wrong image. Makes me sound as though I hunt ghosts instead of people. People being the more dangerous of the two. Ironically, the person who encouraged me to take pride in being a psychic detective was a lieutenant commander for the NYPD, hardly a touchy-feely organization. Don't apologize, he told me when he caught my self-deprecating tone. We've closed several cases on psychic tips. Under the right circumstances, using a psychic certainly merits consideration. So saith the NYPD. I'd like to think that my successes as a psychic, finding lost children, fingering rapists and murderers, have alleviated some suffering. The thought helps me deal with my black moments when I'm face to face with my second sight failures. My second sight failed Tom McGowan. Anyone who's lost their beloved knows how cruel grief can be. The mind replays scenes from the past in heartbreaking detail, and not necessarily the ones you'd expect. I keep remembering McGowan's first kiss, a peck on the forehead. Over and over, I hear the poem he recited that moment. Take this kiss upon the brow, and in parting from you now, thus much let me avow, all that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. How could I not have fallen in love with a cop who quoted Edgar Allan Poe? The most relentless memory is from last summer, the night he nearly pitched us out of a hammock under a star-filled sky. He'd been reaching into his pocket for a diamond ring. 3 weeks later, he was dead. I put the ring away in a cedar box, along with my PI license. I'd intended to let the license expire. Then came a 4 a.m. phone call on a Sunday morning in September. It was Scott Chatfield, an investigator I'd met during that last terrible case. The sound of his voice jerked me right back to the horror of those final dark days in June. Scott, was all I could muster. Sorry to call at such an uncivilized hour, but this won't wait. Is there any way you can get down to the University Medical Center, like in the next hour or so? My heart jumped. An urgent call from a hospital at 4 in the morning has that effect. Has someone been hurt? No, he said, clearing his throat. I mean, yeah, but I heard a commotion in the background, and then the conch shell sound of his palm covering the receiver. After a few seconds, he was back. Shoot, I gotta go. I'll meet you out front. And the line went dead. Shall I stop there?
Here we're back. I turned off the mics. That's wonderful. I as you were reading, I was remembering the end of Aquarius Descending, and I was curious how far in advance you plan your books. For instance, with what happens to Tom, did you know how it was to pick up? How far in advance do you plan?
I really don't plan that far in advance. And let me just say this about that, since the subject has come up. People have asked me about the end of Aquarius Descending, and it was very shocking, you know, to kill such a, you know, kill off, quote-unquote, a main character. And I just, writers out there may understand this. The year that I was writing Aquarius, I lost not one, but two men who were very, very close to me. And I had tried to write a happy ending and sent in two earlier manuscripts, and my editor just said, Martha, these just don't ring true. I mean, they sound hollow and fake. And, you know, I knew that the real ending had to be that Elizabeth would lose Tom.
Hmm.
And it was a tough ending to write. So I didn't really plan that. I, as Barbara was saying, you know, we write into our books what we're living through. And that's what makes it, I think, spring from the page and sound authentic.
Mm-hmm.
So Pisces Rising is as much a story about Elizabeth rising from the despair of losing her lover as it is about, well, there are some other triumphs that occur in that book.
Mm-hmm. Would you each talk about, and you mentioned it earlier, but the research that you do to give your books authenticity. Do you want to continue, Martha?
Oh, I feel like I'm dominating.
Oh, go ahead.
You sure, Barb?
Yeah, I can't say the word, so yeah.
Well, research, for example, Pisces Rising is about Elizabeth investigates a murder on an Indian reservation in San Diego County. Now, I'm not Native American, nor do I know any Native Americans, and I'm not an expert on Native America. So when the muse said to me, you will be writing this book about a murder on an Indian reservation, I went, what? How can I do that? But the universe just sort of puts things in my path that I need, and I was thrashing around the idea for that novel, and I sat down in the chair of a haircutter one day and started chit-chatting about what I did for a living and, you know, blah, blah. And he said, oh, you're a writer. Well, what are you writing about? And I said, well, I think I'm writing this story about an Indian reservation. And he said, really? What reservation? And I said, well, I think it's going to be fictional. And he said, well, you know, I'm a full-blooded Luiseno Indian. If you have any questions, you know, would you like to come out to the reservation and spend some time with me? So, you know, Sal took me out, and I went bumming around the reservation and just got an advance review on the book this morning that I loved this line. They said it was, you know, brilliantly drawn, the reservation.
Okay.
That made me feel very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's how I do my research.
Barbara.
Let's see, when I was writing Unwanted Company, I had one instance where Ellen takes the limo to Tijuana with two men, one of whom is a serial murderer. And so I went to Tijuana with my husband. And actually, I wanted to see the morgue in Tijuana. So I asked a lot of questions, and I finally found a cop in Indio whose mother knew the family that owned these funeral homes in Tijuana that were in 1984 were used as the morgue. So he arranged for his sister to take us around Tijuana, and they lived down in San Ysidro. So my husband and I drove down to pick up the sister, and she said, well, we should bring my mother, and because she really knows the people. And Mama didn't speak English, but that was fine because sister did. And we had a great adventure driving Tijuana. It turns out sister also didn't have a driver's license, insurance, or registration, which we found out when we got stopped by Tijuana police when she was double parked, you know. So, and just seeing the morgue and where they do the embalming and the state it was in, mm-hmm. and the tackiness of it, and it was just great. It was just, I got a lot of great details mm-hmm. from that. So whenever possible, I like to go somewhere. You know, I was just listening to a cop. I go to forensic things whenever cops are talking, homicide cops, and this guy, Gil Carrillo, who actually helped me with my first book and worked on the Night Stalker case, was talking about investigating this murder, and there's this one woman, and, you know, he's showing where they went in her house, and they found this, and they found that, and they found this under her bed and this in her drawer. And then he just looked at us with a smile, and he says, don't ever get murdered, folks, because we learn everything about you. And that was a great line, you know. You pick that up by being there, you know.
Curious about, well, reviews, actually. You mentioned a review, a current review of the book that's coming out, Martha, and you had said something earlier about a review that you got.
Yeah, I got reviewed in Publishers Weekly and Kirkus, which is great, and a couple, like, newsletters from mystery clubs. But this book I'm getting reviewed in the New York Times, which they told me about a week ago, and it's not going to come out to the 6th. So it's like...
February 6th?
Why do I hear about this so far in advance so I can worry about it? But I'm told that she picks 4 out of 400, and she only picks books if she thinks they have merit. So.
Who's reviewing?
Marilyn Stasio,
mm-hmm.
she has that crime.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called, Martha? Crime
stories
or something like that. But, you know, New York Times, I mean, who would have thunk it? That's pretty exciting. So,
how do reviews affect you both? Good ones, bad ones? Although I haven't seen bad ones of your books, but how do they affect you?
I had actually, in the first book, I had one woman say that I learned my police procedure from TV shows. And I went, ow. You know, no, I read a book, you know, but it really made me go out there and make sure I learned correct.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to learn from it, you
mm-hmm.
know, and sometimes you don't agree. So
mm-hmm. what about you, Martha?
I've been really blessed in the area of reviews. The only nasty review I think I remember getting was from Publishers Weekly about The Cold Heart of Capricorn, which I think is an outstanding book. I don't care what anyone says about it.
Yeah.
And I remember the line was something about boilerplate anti-rape propaganda. And the guy I was dating at the time, he just howled at that. He said, yeah, you didn't give those pro-rape people equal time. How dare you, you know? And so I think it must have pushed somebody's butt.
Yeah, you got to wonder who wrote that. You have to wonder who the reviewer was. And it is.
Mm-hmm.
When it boils down to it, it's one person's opinion.
Right.
I met a perfectly goofy woman once in Temecula at a bookstore who said, oh, yeah, I review for Publishers Weekly. And I thought, oh, my gosh, my future's in your hands. I mean, you know, she's a little head case. You know, you don't know.
Hey, I review books, too. In fact, I'm going to be doing a panel at Malice Domestic, which is a mystery conference in Washington, D.C. in May. And the panel.
I will be in Washington, D.C. in May.
Oh, good. Come
What's
to Malice.
The What's the date?
It's 5 through 7.
Cool. That's when I'm going to be there.
And but we're doing a panel on writers who review. And my favorite reviewing experience was I reviewed Stephen King's Bag of Bones.
Mm.
And, you know, this is not, you get assigned the books you review. It's not like I say to the book review editor, gee, I want to review Stephen King. It doesn't happen that way. But so I wrote this review, and I was very nervous about it and all that, and I got a letter back from Stephen King. And he said, you know, among other things, thank you for your review. You know, you have no idea how grateful I am. I loved the book. I thought it was wonderful.
I like that book, too.
And he said, may you live to 120 and have great sex every day of your life. So I have that, of course, framed on my office wall.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guests are Barbara Serinella, author of Unwanted Company, and Martha Lawrence, author of Aquarius Descending with Pisces Rising, coming out next month. No, in March.
In March.
Curious about
points. Next month.
Curious about point of views. Barbara, your books are always in the third person,
yes,
and you have alternating points of views. And Martha, you write in the first person. And I'm curious about that, about why you chose the point of view that you did.
I like to show different. Well, you know, I alternate between Munch and the cop, and now I've been doing the bad guy's point of view, which is really fun to write. You know, it just I enjoy reading stories like that. Also, because my Munch character strays on the autobiographical side, I'm a little nervous using an I with that, because I don't want people to think, you really did that? You know, I'd rather hide behind the fictional third person.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Martha?
I very deliberately chose first person singular because my intention was to show readers what a psychic experience really looked like. And I think that's best done through first person, you know, so that you can be inside the mind of a person who's having a psychic experience. And I think all of us have those experiences, but just dismiss them. Now, granted, I've probably had more dramatic ones than most people, but I think everybody has a touch of it. So I really, that really was my conscious choice. I think third person is really tough. I'm working on a short story right now from multiple points of view, and it's challenging. It's very challenging.
I would think especially in the breadth of a short story.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Do you know the end of your story before you begin?
No. I think I do. It always gets changed, but I start out, you know, believing that I do.
I just sent off 170 pages of my next book with a synopsis to my agent, and in the synopsis I said, and the bad guy is either so-and-so or so-and-so, I haven't decided yet. So I thought, that's pretty cool. I don't know by page 170 who it is. I defy the reader to know definitely who it is.
So how much do you know about the book before you begin?
Well, you know justice needs to be served. You know the bad guy needs to be caught. I love learning what's going to happen as I go along. So, you know, I like unexpected twists that I didn't plan. I was on a panel with Michael Connelly once, and he said, if you know exactly where the book is going, so will the reader.
Hmm.
I thought that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Martha?
I think I know. What was the question exactly?
How much do you know about your book before you begin?
I think the essence of it, I don't know until I've finished my revision. Until the book has been written, my editor has commented, and I've rewritten it, and if there's some point in there where I understand, wow, I really learned something through the process of writing that book. So it's a mystery to me in more ways than one.
Mm-hmm.
It really is an adventure, and I don't get those people who outline every chapter in advance. To me, I have to get into the story and see through the character's eyes before I can see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't see that from up above the novel looking down at it.
Well, plus I usually have introduced new characters with each book, so I learn who they are as I write them. As they come alive on the page, I understand what they're capable of and what they're not capable of.
Exactly.
I'm taking a survey. I'm beginning a new survey, and I'd like to know, what is the most tiresome question interviewers ask you? Barbara?
I have a little advantage because she asked me this outside. And I don't know if I have that, but I think the weirdest question I ever get asked is, how do you divide your day? How do you spend your day? What's your work schedule? I just can't believe that a room of 500 people would care when I eat breakfast and when I sit down behind the computer and when I walk my dogs. And it's like they want this, like, schedule.
As if the answer to that question will help them understand how a novel is written.
Yeah.
Barbara, as you and I know, a novel is written by sitting down and sweating blood. And it doesn't matter what time of day you do it, it's going to be a challenge no matter when you do it.
And yeah, some days it's going to go great, and others, it's not.
Exactly.
I
don't think there's any question an interviewer asked me that I find irritating, because I think it's an honor to be published and it's an honor to be interviewed. I mean, that's the honest answer to that question for me. But I agree, Barbara, that is one that I find bizarre. The answer is so different depending on...
I was asked on a television interview once a question that I was not prepared for, a personal question, and later she edited it out because I just stood there open-mouthed and said, well, I guess my mother won't be watching this one. I won't tell you what it was. Sorry.
Advice regarding agents. Everybody is always interested in what published authors have to say about agents.
Good luck.
Yeah. You mean how you get them or what to do with them once you have
whatever. What comes to mind? I mean,
first thing that comes to mind, and I'll speak from my experience of having looked at hundreds of manuscripts when I was on the other side of the desk in the business. Don't turn in a sloppy manuscript. I mean, that sounds so basic, but it's amazing how many sloppy manuscripts even get through agents with misspellings. If you can't put your best foot forward in your cover letter, then, you need to stop and continue to do work. I think people sometimes think, oh, well, the publishing house will fix that. Mommy and Daddy will fix my mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the publishing house isn't your mommy and daddy, and they're not your mommy and daddy for publicity either or anything. If you want to be an author, you really have to take a lot into your own hands.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say.
How about, I have something more specific regarding agents. In choosing an agent, most people don't have the luxury of making a choice. There's perhaps one agent who responds positively. But is there anything that a person should know in terms of how to choose an agent, how to go after certain ones, or is personality, is that a big deal? How much should you know before you start going for an agent in terms of what you want?
Well, one, you should have a finished piece of work. There's a lot of people who want to know how to get an agent before they finish their manuscript. And I think if you're a first-time author, you have to have a finished product. I think the best way is to go to a writer's conference or some symposium where agents have gathered with the purpose of meeting new authors. And you make that, you impress them because you're showing you're dedicated enough to pay the $300 to go to the conference or whatever. And that, you get an opportunity to sell yourself. I have a girlfriend that's in that process right now, and she met an agent. I introduced them also, but the agent heard some of her work and said, send me your manuscript when it's done, And when she writes that agent, she's going to say, you remember when we met and how much you love my work,
Barbara, your point is well taken that sometimes you just have to take the one that's interested in you. However, I would survey every author that you know or you read. Sometimes an easy way to do that is to look in the acknowledgments pages of authors that you admire and see who they're working with. And chances are that's a good agent.
But meeting them, cold from a letter is really hard, I think. Just saying, I read in the acknowledgments that you were so-and-so's agent and did a good job for them. Will you look at my work?
Or do a little more investigation about them and about the agency.
I understand you like lobster and red roses, and here are a dozen, yeah.
Just sending you a shipment of live lobsters now.
Yes.
Any last words? We are, again, at the end of our hour.
God, that went fast, didn't it?
That went fast. Barbara, I can't wait to read Unwanted Company.
Oh,
ditto.
I can't
wait to read Barbara's work, so I'm thrilled that you have another book out.
Oh, well, we'll be seeing each other on the happy trail.
Yes.
Let's talk about your signings. Martha, your book tour is beginning March?
It is beginning in March. My first signing will be March 11 at Mysterious Bookshop in San Diego. And from there, I think I go to Colorado and Seattle and Portland and points beyond.
It's Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego.
Did I say that?
No, you said Mysterious Bookshop.
I'm sorry.
They all sound alike after
you're
a while.
Forgiven.
Yes. We love Mysterious Galaxy.
On the mind. That'll be probably Mysterious Bookshop in Los Angeles. It will be sometime around the end of March, first part of April.
Okay. Barbara?
Well, I'm doing a lot of events starting actually February 2nd next week. In Orange County, I'm going to have a publication party in Laguna Beach on Sunday, February 6th at 2 p.m., and everybody's welcome, and another one at Borders in Costa Mesa on Thursday, February 10th at 7 p.m., and Jan Burke will be with me then, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, do you enjoy touring? Do either of you enjoy it?
I do. It's like, you know, the whipped cream at the end. I mean, it's, you know, everybody's mm-hmm. praising you. You don't have to work or create anything. You've already finished it. You're just there to take the praise and, you know, see how it goes. Mm-hmm. So it gets kind of old after 3 months, but, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I love meeting the readers and the booksellers. I do always feel like it's cutting into my writing time, and I'm always behind on something, so I'm always, you know, trying to write chapters on the plane between somewhere and feeling rushed. So
you do write during the tour?
I try. Yeah, I do try. I mean, just because of my deadline schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd rather write than tour. To be perfectly honest, I'd rather write than tour, but I do love meeting the readers and the booksellers.
What are each of you reading now?
Oh, God. I picked up Patricia Cornwell's Origin of Death, and I'm reading Diane Leslie's Fleur de Lis' Life of Crime.
She was on the show.
Yeah, isn't she delightful? Mm-hmm. She's really a sweetie. But some cop told me that Patricia Cornwell wrote Good Autopsy, so I wanted to read it for that, but the writing I'm not that impressed with.
What about you, Martha?
I'm indulging. I've got two books on my nightstand right now. One is Void Moon by Michael Connelly.
Oh, I read that in manuscript. Good book.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
And the other is Story by Robert McKee, which mm-hmm. is a nonfiction book about story structure. Wonderful. Highly recommended to anyone who wants to write stories.
Interesting. We have another minute or so left, and mentioning Robert McKee, I'm thinking, you know, in terms of story and character, are they pretty equal in terms of how much work you do with them both?
Gee, you try to do your best with both. I think I'm stronger in character, personally.
I think I'm stronger in character, but I'm learning more and more about the importance of story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it grows out of the character.
Mm-hmm.
The plot grows out of the decisions the character makes.
Hmm. Martha, you have a website.
I do. MarthaLawrence.com.
That's easy.
Do you have one?
No, there's HarperCollins.com. It has my schedule on
mm-hmm.
it and sample chapters and
that's
that kind of stuff.
Very impressive. Okay, last words, pearls of wisdom.
Go ahead, Martha.
Believe in yourself. Write your truth.
Yes, to thine own self be true. Don't listen to them. Just write what makes you feel like you've dug deep to find.
Mm-hmm. I thank you both, of course,
thank
for
you,
being
Mom.
Here again. And you have to come on again with Pisces Rising.
Okay. Okay.
After you've recovered from your tour.
Always wonderful to talk to you, too, Barbara.
Great.
Both of you, Barbara.
I know. Who are you talking to?
And you, too.
Well, yes,
it's
thank you.
It's good to see you again and again and again.
Definitely. I appreciate being here.
And I wish you both luck. And thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Barbara Serinella, author of Unwanted Company, and Martha Lawrence, author of Aquarius Descending. If you want to go to their signings and you haven't written them down, you can email me at bdemarcob@aol.com and I'll get you their schedules. An author who was on back in the summer, Tom Taylor, asked me to mention that he's going to be signing Friday, tomorrow. He's the author of The Big Deal, Hollywood's $1 Million Spec Script. He's also, I believe, a literary agent in Hollywood. He'll be signing at Irvine's Barnes & Noble at 13712 Jamboree tomorrow, 7 p.m. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Writers on Writing is also Internet accessible at KUCI.org. Again, you can email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. Thank you for listening, and remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.